This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 35 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have CBS sports reporter Evan Washburn joining us, who will be in Baltimore this weekend for the AFC Championship game and then in Las Vegas for the Super Bowl, which will air on CBS Sunday, February 11th. Evan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. I know you're from Annapolis. You'll be working in Baltimore this weekend. Is this like your Tommy DeVito story? Like, are you going to be back in the bedroom you grew up in eating chicken parm all week?
Man, I don't know if it's that captivating, but there are some similar touch points to it. You're right. I grew up in Annapolis, but I've lived in Baltimore in the city limits for over 10 years now. And this is now home, and grew up sort of following the Ravens. I'm 39, so they showed up when I was in elementary / middle school. And then some of my early jobs in media as a production assistant, field producer, was being out at the Ravens facility on a daily basis and covering games. So it does feel like a bit of a full circle moment.
Were you a fan of a different NFL team when the Ravens moved to Baltimore?
So, you know, growing up around here or in Annapolis, my dad's from Baltimore. He was a huge Colts fan. They go to Indy, and that becomes a point of contention. And then he kind of watched Washington. So that was the team, I guess, just because it was on in the market. And then, yeah, when the Ravens showed up, had buddies whose family had tickets, so we would get to go to games. And then that first Super Bowl was definitely right in the zenith there of being a sports fan when you're in high school. And the second time around, I was more ingrained in the business. And so it's, as we know, and you know, once you kind of find out where the sausage is made, it takes a little bit of the fandom out of it. But I can appreciate it for the city. And now having an 8-year-old son who's a huge Ravens fan, it's pretty cool.
Sure. And this is going to be your fourth Super Bowl that you're covering for CBS?
Yeah, it's wild to say, but yeah, it'll be Super Bowl number 4.
What is that week like? What is when do you head to Vegas, and how packed is the schedule for you that week?
It's a unique week. You usually get in the Sunday night, so basically a week out. And I've had different versions of it over the years, and I would say a lot of it is just kind of managing your energy and building up. I mean, not to the level that the athletes are, but you can burn it too much early because you're so excited. There are plenty of work things you need to take care of, but there's just a lot going on. And what I've found is you want to take care of the meetings and the things that we have that are scheduled. And then hopefully by Friday, you're really shutting it down and then just kind of treating it like a normal game week. Because as you know, Brandon, for us as broadcast crew, we usually arrive in a city on a Friday, sometimes late Friday. And so that's kind of the normal rhythm. So getting to the city of the game with both teams there on Sunday or Monday, by the time Friday rolls around, you can kind of feel exhausted by the whole process.
Sure.
So I feel like I got a pretty good rhythm of it. And what's good, too, is on off years where we don't have the Super Bowl on CBS, I still go out and cover the event or the week leading up for all of our studio and radio shows. So I feel like I've got Super Bowl week mastered. Now that said, it hasn't been in Vegas, so this will be an added layer of a challenge on a lot of levels, but I'm pumped for it.
When you go out there, when CBS doesn't have the game and you're still there for media day and that week leading up to it, do you stay for the Super Bowl or do you come back home beforehand?
Yeah, I get out on Friday afternoon. It's a challenging experience to go to a Super Bowl when you're not the host network. I mean, you're just like everybody else. I mean,
Sure. Obviously
there's media core that are there, but I've always been excited about the opportunity to get back and watch it from the friendly confines of the couch.
What was the feeling like in your first Super Bowl game? What were your nerves like? Are you able to be there on camera and ignore the fact that you're on TV and 100 million people are watching you in that moment?
That first one was pretty paralyzing on a lot of fronts. It was just my second year covering the NFL for CBS on the sidelines. And the thing I always say is your head's spinning 100 miles an hour in lead up and the days leading up because of the fact that you're constantly reminded of how big of an event it is. And specific to Super Bowl 50 out there in Santa Clara, I was incredibly nervous. But the coolest thing that happened was once I got through the first kind of on-camera element, I know it was an interview, quick interview with Ron Rivera as he came out of the tunnel. And then we had the anthem with Lady Gaga. And I had this moment of, whoa, this is, it kind of hits you. And thankfully, there was real appreciation in that moment. But the coolest thing, and I've had this happen again when we did the Super Bowl in Atlanta, when it was Rams, Patriots, I put Tampa kind of on an island for all the obvious reasons of COVID. Yep. The game starts, Brandon. It truly does feel like a normal game. And it, honestly, it feels less like a normal game. This week will be more intense in terms of the environment in Baltimore, where you've got the pulsating noise and you can kind of, you're living it with the crowd, because Super Bowls are two fan bases. At times can be a corporate crowd because of the level of the event. So once the game starts, it almost really quiets down and feels normal. And that part's awesome because you still know that it's the biggest sporting event we have.
Have you ever had a moment where the broadcast was thrown to you? And I mean, not just in a Super Bowl or even in a big game, but in any game, in any sport, have you ever had it thrown to you and you just froze up for whatever reason?
Thankfully, knock on wood, I haven't had a freeze up moment. I did have a funny one, and it was just last year. It was during the NCAA tournament. It was the Elite Eight game. So it was San Diego State and Creighton. And Ian Eagle was the play-by-play guy, and obviously I worked with him for the last 9 years. And it was that opening hit, and for whatever reason, when he threw it to me, and I thanked myself. So instead of saying, thanks, Ian, I said, thanks, Evan. And it was hilarious. In the moment, it really caught me off guard. I mean, that's the closest, again, knock on wood, because it's not that bad. It's more funny than anything. Closest thing to sort of like an initial freeze up or blunder out of the gate.
How is working with Ian Eagle and Charles Davis?
Oh, it's the worst. It's unbelievable. Look, I'm sure you've hopefully crossed paths with both those guys. They're kind of living legends in a lot of ways. And it's been, Ian's, you know, become a really close friend. Obviously, I admire his work and the way he does it and how he's been able to do it. He kind of elevates everybody around him with his skill level. And then with Charles, it's been cool because he joined our crew after having Dan Fouts for such a long time. And Dan was you know, a larger than life figure on so many levels. And Charles joined us during COVID. So like we really kind of had to get to know each other and under odd circumstances, a lot like you and I are right now. And it kind of feels like he's been around for the last 9 years too, at least in terms of my connection to the crew. So I couldn't ask for a better environment. It's kind of the coolest thing where you get to go to work every weekend for these games. And the easiest part of the week is going to the stadium and calling the game with guys that you're friends with. And then people behind the scenes that you have such deep ties to as well.
And are you doing any college basketball work now, or does that not start until after the NFL season?
It doesn't this year start until after the season. I'll do a couple regular season games on Sports Network and then move into that kind of conference tournament. And then obviously the NCAA tournament run. It kind of varies year in and year out. Sometimes they'll sprinkle in some studio shifts up in New York or a couple games here and there. But I appreciate it because for whatever reason, this has felt like a pretty full football season.
Sure.
And it's kind of hard to bounce from back and forth.
And are you able to follow college basketball during the NFL season, or do you need to get like a crash course from John Rothstein after the Super Bowl?
It's a great question. And yeah, Rothstein, I appreciate when I'm in studio and he's there. I could have not seen a college basketball game since the previous year. And all I have to do is say, and for more on that, yeah, John, what do you got? And he'll take it for the next minute 30 or however long he needs to before we go to break. But I try my best, whether it's at night when you're kind of winding down and you see what games are on. I've always had this idea that I would kind of study a portion of what's happening on a day-to-day basis. But the reality is, it's kind of hard to, at least for me, my style is I'm all in on whatever it is I'm doing. And I found that specific to getting ready for conference tournaments and then the NCAA tournament, if I can do a somewhat of a crash course post-Super Bowl in that kind of two-week period before the conference tournaments, I'm in pretty good shape.
How did you get started in TV? Was broadcasting always a goal for you? Did you have aspirations of playing professional lacrosse when you were in college?
So I did, yeah. I mean, I always say I was not someone that kind of looked at this career as something that was destined to be my future from a young age. And I'm around so many, as you are, talented to broadcasters that you know, Ian would be an example of it. Like, he kind of knew this is what he was going to do at a young age. For me, it was all about playing sports. And you mentioned lacrosse, playing that in college, that the goal was to play professionally. Injuries kind of got in the way late. But whenever you're at home for Thanksgiving or Christmas and people are asking, what are you going to do? I had to come up with something to say. So I would kind of think to myself, all right, what am I going to do when I'm done playing sports? Because the lacrosse thing, as it's grown now, and I'm pumped for what Rabel and the PLL are doing, it's still not necessarily built to be a full-time career. I thought, well, I like sports. I like watching television. Why don't I just marry the two? Having no idea, Brandon, what goes into producing sports and being a part of a sports production or being in the sports media business. And I would just say that. I'd be like, oh, I'll be a sports broadcaster. And that kind of put the people to bed to the side that were wondering what you're going to do when you get out of college. But I was faced with that when my college career ended in 08 and I graduated and I'm back home in Annapolis at my parents' house and thinking, oh, wow, I've been saying this for about a year and a half and have done nothing to set myself up for it. And then I just kind of went into full mode of, by any means necessary, getting opportunities, and was lucky enough to kind of get in at a TV station in DC. And that kind of at least opened the world to me of like, all right, what is this? And then I fell in love with it.
What was your degree in college? Like, were you taking communications courses or anything like that? Were you involved in a college radio station or something? Like, how did you go from finishing school and then being like, all right, like now I got to start trying to dive into this career? And then what is it, 6 years later, you're working on a Super Bowl?
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, so much more exciting, and I love how condensed it feels when you lay it out that way. So I was actually an English major, and this is where we should bring in my mom, because she didn't want me to be a communications major for whatever reason, because she's highly intellectual, and she thought that it was, I don't know, a better idea to be an English major and a journalism concentration. But that actually meant that I had to be an English major and take all of these deeply intense theory classes about literature and all these things. I struggled, Brandon. I've been transparent on a lot of fronts. I was not a great student. I grinded my way through. I'm dyslexic. That's not an excuse, but it has been a challenge. I was focused on playing lacrosse and having fun, and then school became probably third on that list. And I did grind it through. I didn't have any experience outside of writing a little bit for the school paper, but that was more of an assignment for a class. The challenge when you're an athlete, and I'm sure you've talked to athletes that have transitioned into sports media, your time is so wrapped up in practice. So like when you could go work for the radio station to call games, I was either playing in the game or practice. Right. So that became tough. And then every summer I would have either had to go to summer school, or I was dealing with injuries and had to be focused on getting back healthy. So all that said, I did nothing to put myself in position to be successful right out of college. And what ended up happening was, and I'll try and be as condensed with this as possible, I got an internship at Comcast Sportsnet DC, which is now actually Monumental Sports. It's Ted Leonsis' network, but it went from that to NBC DC. And I was able to get the internship through Joe Beninati, who's the voice of the Capitals, because he called lacrosse games. Long story short, he knew some of the same people I did in the lacrosse world. But the funny thing was, is the internship was for college students. And at this point, I'm out of college. And so I'm emailing with the internship coordinator, who ended up being younger than I was. At the time, I had no idea. So I'm being very proper and formal in the email, saying, Mr. Jackson, this is Brian Jackson. He still works in media. And at one point, I was like, I'm going to have to like pay for a community college class to just get an internship. And we were able to work around it. And that internship opened everything, because I just, similar to sports for me, or anything really, once I get focused on it, I just lived at the station. So all the other interns were college kids. They had to go to class and stuff. I just went to the station every day and either worked in the feed room, you know, in the studio, out in the field. And that kind of gave me what I've always described as kind of like a crash course on how to either produce television or be on television. And it kind of laid the foundation that I then was able to use to kind of rise up. And then just to kind of bookend it with the 6-year window, the lacrosse angle kind of came back around, where I got to get on air calling games as an analyst before I did anything involved with sort of general reporting, hosting. And that got me going in probably a direction that I wouldn't have been able to had I just been coming at it as sort of your general person involved or excited or interested in being an on-air reporter.
And what about now? I mean, you're still very young by industry standards. Is sideline reporting now, is that your passion? Do you have an interest in play-by-play or want to host studio shows?
No, it's a great question. And if you'd asked me probably 3 years ago, I would have been very strident in saying, I want to be, you know, a host, and I want to do X, Y, and Z. And because you see all these people around that have some of those elevated positions. And look, those are legitimate goals. And I would never be one to say, oh, I'm not interested in that. But what I've really become interested in now, Brandon, is just being part of it, like longevity and being consistent and specific to sideline reporting on the NFL. And this is my 10th season, and I'll be honest, I feel like it took maybe 6, possibly 7 seasons. And look, I'm sure everybody else's journey is a little different, for me to be truly comfortable and somewhat accepted into what is a very insular world and challenging world of the NFL. I mean, it's sports at the highest level. As you know, you watch and you listen to coaches and players, like, it's for a good reason. They don't want to open up because they're being covered by the masses and they've got to be private. And then there's competitive advantages. So all that's to say, it takes a while, I think, to know how to do the job, whether it be sidelines or covering the league, and especially the way I like to do it. And the way I like to do it is to feel really connected to the people that are playing it and coaching it. And so that took a while. So I finally feel like I'm in this place where when I go to a game, I can have kind of real conversations with the people that are starring in these games and coaching these games. Not that to say all that makes it on air, not that sort of thing, but it's like, man, I've put in a lot of sweat equity in trying to build out a reputation within the league. Why would I want to do anything else right now than kind of ride this wave? So that's kind of my immediate focus. But the thing that I add to it that has become just my real passion is I love the opportunity to do long form conversations with players and coaches, whether that be in the feature world, whether that be in sit down interviews for NFL Today, whether that exists on audio platforms. Those are to me things that I feel like I get to stretch another muscle and also feel like really lean on what is my strength. Is my ability to sort of connect with people and understand their story and what they're about, and not try and just lean on whatever the surface level side of things is. So the answer to your question, I want to do this as long as I can and then just find additive layers to this job that challenge me creatively or professionally. So that really could be anything.
You mentioned it took a while to become accepted. Was it harder to become accepted by the teams, the players and coaches, or was it harder to become accepted by your peers in broadcasting? Because I'm sure there were plenty of people who were gunning for, an opportunity to be a sideline reporter at the Super Bowl.
No, thankfully. I mean, everybody, especially at CBS, I mean, like I'm forever grateful because, yeah, I got opportunity early on when maybe my paper resume didn't match what I was able to do when kind of the red light came on. And so that's been great. And I think one of the cool things in our business is you've got folks that have been around for a long time because it's such a great job. Why would you want to leave it? So early on in my career, I worked with Greg Gumbel and Bob Fishman, who's a Hall of Fame director. Now my producer is Mark Wolf. He's been doing this for a really long time. We already touched on Ian Eagle and then Dan Fouts. And so I got to, in those early formative years, be around some real legends in the business. Obviously, when I would join the A Crew this week and reconnect with Tracy and Jim Nance and Jim Rickoff and Mike Arnold, like, that stuff matters, especially those first few years, because you kind of get to see, all right, well, these people have been doing it for whatever, 30, 40 years. They must have something figured out. I should add Suzanne Smith to that list as well. So that side of it was accepting from day one, which I'm, again, so appreciative of. The football side, it's just they've got to get to know who you are. So everybody's really professional in these production meetings or right. if you're doing an interview, post-game, pre-game, whatever it might be. But I've found once you break through and they kind of get to know who you are and that you're somebody they can trust and you're not there for ulterior motives or at least specific to that moment, then you get a different version both on camera and off. And then to me, that becomes a better version for the viewer, whether it's the information that we're getting that we can pass along, or in those on-camera moments, you get to see the human being, which is always my goal.
How is working with Jim Nance and Tony Romo on these big NFL games now that you'll be bumped up to the A-team?
Oh, it's cool. It's awesome. I mean, Tony is everything you see on television in terms of his excitement level for the game and just kind of how authentic he is as a guy. And then Jim is one of the biggest legends in our business. But at this point, he's, and he, I'm sure, feels good about this. He's just, another guy on the crew. And that part, especially early on, I remember my first opportunity with those folks was ahead of Super Bowl 50 on the AFC Championship game. So this would have been Broncos, Patriots, Manning, Brady. And Lance Barrow was the producer of that crew at that point. Mike Arnold was the director. And then it was Jim and Phil. And then I knew Tracy a little bit, or at least we'd met at some seminars at CBS. But like that first time was another examples of, oh, man, I'm so thankful. They're just treating me like part of the crew, even though I'm at that point 2 years into this thing. And this is our first game together and it's going to be one of the biggest games of the year. So all those moments kind of reminders that, hey, we're all here just kind of doing a job. And the real key is to treat everybody with the same level of respect, no matter if you're the highest level of this business or you're just kind of breaking in.
Is it challenging to join a broadcast crew for one or two games in a season? Like, is there already a built-in chemistry there that you now feel you need to fit in? Does there need to be chemistry there, or are you kind of doing your own thing?
It's a great question, Brandon. And I would say this, it's challenging. I'm thankful that I've done it now a number of times. And my approach is I'm there to help this crew. They've been doing this now for 18 weeks of regular season plus two playoff games. So they're 20 weeks in, plus they're, multiple years in at this point.
Right.
I'm not there to do exactly what I do on our crew. And the relationship and chemistry that I have with Charles and Ian, but more importantly, at some points, Mark Wolf and the truck and Suzanne, like we have a working kind of language and rhythm. So when I join this crew, and it's also associated with these events and these games, it's more I am there to help in any way possible and make sure that for this weekend, I'm covering the Ravens sideline. I want them to have that thing absolutely locked down. So it's not so much about what I can bring and what I've done and the things that I want to make sure get in the show. It's, I want them to feel like, hey, we had that sideline covered. Nothing was missed, whether it be injury, dynamics on the sideline. The littlest thing is the biggest thing on these games. So that's kind of my mentality. I'm there to join their machine. And if less is more, often is the case.
I'm sure you've seen some of the outside criticism of Tony Romo over the last year or so. And obviously you're working Sundays, so you're not necessarily listening to him. But now that you get to when you are working up close with him, what is his preparation like?
I mean, I'm always impressed with just the way that he sees the game. And you get windows of that when you're watching him call games. And I think that's what you want from that position. I always, and look, I mentioned it briefly, like I started in this business as the analyst for college lacrosse games, and I still get to do that. And I honestly bring that mentality to sidelines. Now the jobs and responsibility are much different, but the most important thing I think is to be constantly giving me the why and not the what. And I think more often than not, you do get that when you listen to Tony call games. And that's what, when I'm not with him Monday through Saturday by any means, but yeah, when I'm in those production meetings and we're going through elements and he's making points and he's adding things that I think are like, oh, wow, I didn't see it that way. That's kind of always what I judge games on, and those that do the job, whether it be mine or up in the booth. It's like, hey, did I walk away from that kind of feeling like I have a better understanding of the why and not necessarily just kind of what happened? And that's kind of how I see it.
Would you like the opportunity to interview Taylor Swift either during the championship game or Super Bowl?
Look, I would never turn down the opportunity, but I'm not sure I'm the one that should be doing it because I'm just not necessarily informed enough on her catalog, let's say, as I've come to understand, as I've seen even, you know, my buddy Ian throwing in references, and I just didn't get it. I obviously know who Taylor Swift is. I've listened to her songs, but I'm not a devoted listener. And so I feel like if I did the interview, people would be very disappointed in all the things I missed and the things I didn't have, as much as I would be if somebody was interviewing John Harbaugh ahead of this game and they didn't ask the important questions. So I just don't think I'm the guy for the job.
Yeah, I think you did a great job of choosing your words carefully there to, you know, not say anything negative about Taylor Swift, but also still absolutely make it clear not that, you know, you're not a diehard fan. Is there one player or coach that you would consider the toughest person to interview?
Toughest interview? I mean, I would say the ones that challenge you are the ones that, and it's, again, kind of goes back to that protective nature of this league. It's not even so much like it's a, you know, abrasive situation, yeah, but it's like they don't want to open up. So, yeah. I mean, I'll go back in time. I mean, the ones that always made, like interviewing Gronk back in the day, especially when it'd be like an on-camera post game, like you could tell there was the answer he wanted to give and then the answer he knew he should give. And I think specifically to a divisional round game, they had just beaten the Chiefs. And he had been dealing with some injury. He was always beat up, such a tough dude. And I had thought all game or even leading up, like if I interview Gronk, I've got a way of it, framing a question. And this is where I could really nerd out with you. Like framing of questions to me is the most important thing because you can – that's where it becomes the sort of the boxing match with somebody you're interviewing and somebody who could be challenging or somebody who doesn't want to answer a question or doesn't want to open up. If you frame it a certain way, you box them, you paint them into a corner where they have to get out unless they just say, oh, I'm not going to answer that. But you know what I mean? So whatever, fast or rewind back to this divisional round game against the Chiefs. It was some, I asked it in a certain way where he actually kind of, I think, froze for a moment and smiled because he saw what I was doing and it clicked with him. And to Gronk's credit, he was still able to give me the Patriot approved answer without without giving too much. But he comes to mind in that form. But nobody's. I always say that the beauty of our situation. Now I could have to do it Sunday, and I'll have to do it Super Bowl Sunday. I'm usually interviewing people in moments of joy. They've won, or it's ahead of a big game. There might be some nerves there, but they're not sad. They're not upset. We do in-game interviews for the NCAA tournament, so those ones have been challenging. I'm sure I thought more. I could think of one that didn't go great. But again, most of the time, it's a moment of joy, so it's not tough. But those, man, those posts, I've done a few of the AFC Championship losing coach, and then I've done, because Tracy, because she's our lead reporter and deserves this, she takes the winning interview in the Super Bowl, no matter the winner. So I've got loser duty. Yeah. And, man, those have been tough. Ron Rivera that first year, God, he was such a class act. Sean McVay, class act. And then I had Andy on Zoom, like on a two-way during that COVID Super Bowl, which was odd because I don't think I saw him. I just heard his voice. So those ones, you really have to be on your game in terms of like using a sensitive tone while also having to ask the right question. I know specific to last year was Zach Taylor in the Bengals. Remember that, I'm forgetting his name, the defensive lineman who pushed Mahomes out of bounds that extended that drive that basically gave – the Chiefs that AFC Championship game. That's a question you got to ask about. And so it was in the moment thinking, how do I respect where Zach's coming from as a coach, but also have him address what was the pivotal play in the game or felt like it, at least in the moment. So those are challenging. I appreciate those moments, but they're probably, going back to your initial questions, the harder ones to do.
Do you ever feel like you're competing against an interview subject? Like you're trying to get information or interesting quotes out of the player or coach. And most of the time they are just like that Gronk one, just trying to get through without making a headline.
I'm sure early on I was, because I thought, well, if I don't get something out of this, then I've lost, using the kind of competitive metaphor there. But at this point, Brandon, like I've kind of gotten to the point, if the subject doesn't want to do it, one, I'd rather not do it. But if we're going to do it, then I will, you know, I'm going to ask my questions. I'm going to be respectful to the process. But this is a two-way street. Like this is, and granted, that could be a different situation if you're doing 60 Minutes or HBO Real Sport. Like if you're doing an investigative piece, but in our world where it's a pregame interview or it's a halftime interview or it's postgame. Like I'm going to approach it a certain way to try and get something out of you that is informative, entertaining to the viewer. But if you don't want to engage, 100% you're right. And I'll go through the process with you and we'll keep it moving.
I'm sure you saw the Carissa Thompson headlines a few months ago where she said, the quote was, I would make up the report sometimes. And that was during her time as a sideline reporter for Fox. So I will ask you, have you ever made up a report from a player or a coach?
Absolutely not. No, I wouldn't begin to do that.
How did you feel when you saw that from Carissa?
I mean, it was shocking. I got it sent to me from, you know, plenty of people both in and out of the business because it became a thing. But I guess my view on it was, I do think everybody does, and this isn't just specific to sideline reporting, I would say everybody does the job kind of their own way. Now there are parameters in which you have to play, and that would fall outside of the parameters because you never want to lose the trust of the coaches and players and the people that you're covering. But I kind of think about it in the sense that I don't lump myself in with a whole group because I kind of view it like I'm doing my version of the job and I'm doing it my way. So that was kind of it didn't affect me because I never looked to anyone really as like, okay, well, that's how I've got to do it. Or if they do it that way, then I've kind of find a way to match that. And that goes back to the idea of it takes a little while, or it took me a little while to figure out, you'll get comfortable in this position, especially covering the NFL. But while it may appear on air that what I'm doing is just like what, you know, any other sideline reporter is doing, I know I'm approaching it with my specific brand and version of things. And so I don't really get that concerned with other people's approach.
Did you feel like it kind of gave sideline reporters a bad rap?
No, because I honestly I was more interested in and struck by how it illuminated the position. It a lot of people learned about the behind the scenes of the job that probably had no idea. So in some odd way, that could be, you know, beneficial. I think one of the things is, and the word trust to me always comes up, and you have, all you have is your name and your reputation. And I think about this a lot in this job, where everything to me is a cost-benefit analysis, whether it's when I'm talking to you or I'm talking to a coach off camera or a player off camera, and then how does that conversation, how is that pushed forward on camera or on the broadcast? You always have to be thinking, okay, is this situation worth risking or challenging the trust level that, or the reputation or relationship that you've built with whoever it might be? And I've found that if you have that mentality and you really evaluate things, you can still be yourself. You're getting, this is me, I'm not holding anything back necessarily, but I'm also not looking to just kind of be carefree about everything at all times and not think about, hey, how does what I'm going to say impact, you know, whether it be the people you work for, work with, or cover? Because in this business, that's kind of the lifeblood of it.
I know you mentioned that you you'll get the losing team at the Super Bowl, and Tracy will get the winning team after the game. Do you have to fight through the crowds to get to them, or is it a little bit easier because the losing team is trying to get off the field quickly?
No. So the way that process works is, man, I actually, now you say that, that was another weird COVID one we did do. And this is, I mean, Sean McDermott's, you know, he earned a lot of points in my book, because we were doing the interviews from, I was in the stands. We were in the first row of the stands.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'd have to do like field to stands.
Right.
Because so in a normal circumstance, so whether it be Sunday or in 3 weeks in Vegas, losing team goes off, they go to their locker room, they cool down, as they say, and then I'm immediately posted up right in front of their locker room door, outside their locker room door, with a camera operator and waiting for the coach to come out. And usually they'll come out within 10, 15 minutes, and then you do it right there, and it's usually, you know, pretty quiet and empty. But so I'm not fighting through crowds, but the one, I'm glad you brought it up, because again, it was an incredible moment of him kind of doing his job, as they say. When the Bills lost to the Chiefs in Arrowhead, confetti's coming down, they're leaving, and McDermott decided ahead of time, and I was like, no way he's going to do this if they lose. But he did. He stopped at the top of the tunnel, because that's where our setup was. And he did the 2-3 question losing AFC championship interview on the field with all that going on around him. So, you know, I'm forever sort of appreciative of his professionalism in that moment, because I don't know if I could have handled that. I would have found some way to go to another room. Yeah, we'll do it on Zoom in 20 minutes. So that would have been my thought. But so that's kind of how that works.
And what about halftime? What is that like? Are you chasing coaches down, or are they do they know that they're required to talk?
Yeah, each coach has their own style. Some do like to have a brisk walk. I've done some jogging. I think it kind of varies. Like if you're getting a coach going in at half, there's more of an urgency usually to kind of like, hey, let's keep it moving, because we're talking off camera and doing the notes deal. And then coming back out, it's more of like, hey, walk as we head back out. That's why I like to think of myself. I'm still an athlete. I'm always to the coach. I'm like, hey, man, you want to jog? We can jog and sprint. I'm keeping up. So no one's gotten away from me yet.
Was the craziest interview that Well, let me say this. Because you were in the middle of a pre-production meeting with Bill Belichick and about to meet with Tom Brady when you got word that your wife went into labor. So what was the stress level there? Did you leave? Did you tell them that it was happening? Like, I can't imagine the emotions in that moment.
Yeah. So a little backstory, and it's good timing, because we just had the 8-year anniversary of that moment. Hudson Washburn turned 8 on January 22nd. So we're taking this a day later, and it was an opportunity to revisit that moment with him and obviously with my wife, Kate. So we were out in Denver, and we had actually met, I think, with the Broncos that morning, and we were back at the hotel. And where are you coming from right now? Where do you live?
Long Island.
Okay, so you may have gotten a taste of this. There was a massive snowstorm that week. So that was happening. So my wife was at the grocery store getting kind of supplied up for the snowstorm to hunker down with our dog, and her water broke. And that's when she called me and was like, looks like something's happening here. And so I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm about to leave the hotel to go meet with the Patriots. My dad at that point was living in Baltimore, but not that close. And so Kate was able to actually get an Uber to the hospital. I immediately call my dad en route to meet with the Patriots. And I'm like, hey, you know, Kate's headed to the hospital. Looks like, you know, she's in labor. This is happening. Keep me posted. Knowing that Kate wouldn't be able to for the most part. So yeah, we get to the hotel where the Patriots are staying. We're sitting in a conference room, and these AFC Championship and Super Bowl, sometimes some other, you know, the rooms are a little bit bigger. There's more people in production that are there. And again, this is my first time joining this crew with Lance Barrow, legend, Jim Nance, legend, Phil Simms, legend, Tracy, you know, legend. And I'm like, I'm just focused. I've done stuff with Bill, but that's still, you know, that's got its dynamics. And he's wrapping up, and my phone just starts buzzing. But I'm like, I'm not answering this. Like, I can't. So he kind of wraps up, and I'll never forget this. It was when we had Mike Carey with us, and Bill and Mike Carey got into some prolonged conversation about officiating. And it was kind of way in the weeds, but we're all kind of just listening because it is interesting. But I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking, like, my phone's ringing and I got to answer this thing or at least look at it. And so Bill and Mike finally wrap up. And then so he's getting up to leave. Tom's walking in. I pick my phone up, swipe, and it's a picture of my son. He'd already been born. My dad had been able to either get into the whatever room or they'd sent him the picture. So I'm looking at so talk about, you know, to your point about emotions at that point, yeah. I sort of compartmentalized things thinking it was like, all right, well, this will happen later. But no, it happened. And so I think, all right, how do I handle this? Again, I didn't want to involve anybody in this. I told no one on the crew because I didn't know him that well. And I'm not the kind of guy who's like, hey, here's what's happening in my life. So I kind of sneak out as Tom's doing, like, hey, what's up, everybody? Stuff. I call Kate, and she's able to answer. I'm now thinking about that. Like, how is she able to do that? She answers. I do the, like, I love you. How's everybody doing? Like, healthy. She's Hudson healthy. Yeah, we're great. We're great. It's good. All right. Well, Tom's walking in. So I got to go in. And I always say this too. I mean, she's unbelievable. So supportive of this whole crazy lifestyle, but she is from Massachusetts. So I think the fact that it was the Patriots kind of helped the situation. So yeah, I kind of sneak back in to the room as Tom's like just sitting down, getting going with it. And I just kind of acted like nothing was happening. I did tell Tracy because I knew her a little bit. And I was like, I don't really want to make a big thing of this. So I didn't, no one knew until after the game Sunday. I remember Jen Sabatel, who, you know, kind of came up to me and was like, hey, you know, I can't remember, but whatever. I ended up telling people after. So yeah, it was wild. It was so memorable. I would have loved to have been there. Hudson was 5 weeks early. So I feel like it's kind of, there's somewhat of a built-in excuse there.
Yeah, it's tough to plan for.
Tough to plan for, but it does make for a great story, not just for opportunities like this, but I think for Hudson, I mean, he's a huge sports fan. He loves playing sports. He plays football. Like, you know, maybe one day I've told the story to Belichick. I don't know if I've told it to Tom. I've told it to the crafts, like they know. So it's like, it's one of those where it's a good kind of, it's a good thing that he'll have forever to be able to say, you know, I was born, my dad was with the greatest coach and quarterback of all time.
Yeah. Very cool. I don't know if this is easy to assess, but what is the percentage of information that you get from those pre-production meetings leading up to a game that you then use or implement during a broadcast?
For me specifically or for the whole crew?
For you specifically.
I would say, so if you do one for one, so a meeting with the two teams, Friday or Saturday, and then game Sunday, I would say for me, on average, maybe 5%, 10%, not much. Like, it's not.
So is that because you're sitting in a lot of meetings where other people are kind of doing most of the talking, or is that based off of?
The way I would lay it out, and this is, again, this is something I've learned and I find valuable. So twofold. One, and this is where I love my crew. Like, I get a lot of leeway in those meetings to ask questions. Cause I think at this point they know that if I'm going to ask a question, it's going to be something that will be additive. I would say two things. One, I'm not necessarily going to have the opportunity to kind of give the, whatever we got from the meeting, because sometimes it's just easier for Charles and Ian to relay that. We have a pretty healthy process of, like, we like to call it, like, we sandwich things. So they'll tee it up and then I'll add from something else. And then they'll kind of back end it. That allows it to feel like a conversation and not like a constant departure to go down to the field. But early on in my career, you go production meeting. Okay. This is great. I'm going to get all this stuff. You do get stuff. Right. And then you're like, okay, I got to use it in the game. Because, like, that's what the whole point is. That's the process. Production meeting, game, use the information in the game. The way to play the game is, especially our crew, where we're stacked up is the beat crew. So we see a lot of the same teams. Like, we did 5 Cleveland Browns games. We did 4 Steelers games. You got to kind of have this group. Don't waste information. Don't force it into a broadcast, because we're kind of precious about stuff too. Like, probably maybe overly precious, but to this point, don't push something into a game because it's a good note or a good story or a good element or good, you know, thing you learn from a player or coach in the next game just because you just talked to them. If you don't use it, that's fine. We're going to have the Browns in 3 weeks, and it might come up then and be so much more appropriate, so much more germane to what's happening, really additive to what's going on in the game. That to me, is production meetings, it's a 18-week, as we now go into the playoffs. Like, I've done 3 Ravens games. I did their preseason games because I live in Baltimore. I might use something in tomorrow or Sunday's AFC Championship game that I got from a production meeting in August or a training camp visit in August. Like, that's the way to approach it, as whether you're a reporter, you're a play-by-play, whether you're an analyst, like a producer. Like, those meetings are 20 minutes to learn about that, obviously what's happening at that moment, but right, you know, that is in your war chest, is in your computer, whatever you want to call it, that you can employ. I could use in a podcast at some point. Like, now granted, you have to be careful sometimes, like if it's, you know, in that regard, but that's my view of, so the percentages to me don't equate the value when it comes to how much ends up on air the following day or 2 days out from the meeting.
So do you go into a game kind of knowing what you're going to use, or is it dependent on what's going on in the game? And
no, my approach to the job is, you know what you're going to do, your pre-kick, your open report. At least, you know, you have an idea of it the night before, because we lay out, like, all right, here's how we're going to go in the air. That can change morning of if something happens. 95% of the time it doesn't. And then from there, I have, I could pull one up. I have manila folders where I kind of transpose what I think was most interesting from our meetings. But to use that previous point, I also have those notes from whatever previous meetings we've had with that team. So by week 17, when we had Baltimore, I had the notes from 3 previous games. So that is my shorthand way of, like, when things are happening in game, and Ian and Charles are going a certain direction, I'll go, oh man, that, you know, it's a nice layer to that, that thing that Lamar said. Again, it could have been at our meeting that week, or remember when Lamar said that thing 3 weeks ago, and then I'll pull it up and I'll make sure I have like the general sense of his quote or his note or what he said. And then that's like the quick add. Like, to me, sideline reporting is you're kind of the editorial consultant on the field. Like, yes, you got to cover injuries, and that falls into editorial to some degree. You're the insurance policy. You're there like, hey, are we covering everything, one, and are those guys covering whatever they want to cover to a level of depth that they need to be or we could be? And that's where hopefully you have things to add. Where it, to me, goes in a different direction, it's like, I have this great story from the production meeting. One, the game's not just as, you know, going that direction, or those guys aren't interested or having that discussion. Why in the world would you take the viewer or the listener and be like, woof, let me go 180 degrees the other way? Even if it's an awesome story, unfortunately, it's not going to resonate, because it's like kind of lost in the like, wait, what, why? We were just talking about their defense, but now we're talking about, you know. So that's kind of my process as I approach a game. I try and kind of like, all right, I know Ian and Charles really well. What has them jacked up for this game? What are their things that, whether it's our conversations or just knowing their personalities, that they're going to go? So it's like, I try and target my prep and my approach, because you're there to service the booth, you're there to service the viewer, and those two things need to be aligned.
Is there almost an art to making the most of your question when your time is limited?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. I mean, to me, the art, especially in those, like really could be halftime, it could be post-game, you're catching these coaches and players in such an incredibly high stress, high emotion period. So think of like, for you or I, when like we're at that, like your brain's going a million miles an hour, you think. So what I've found, the longer the question, the less success you're going to have when it comes to a thoughtful response. That's just basic to me mechanics of, the more words they hear, the less they're going to understand. So in turn, they're going to go to default mode. I have 7 responses that I've used over the course of time that I know I can go to in a moment. This is the athlete. I'm speaking as an athlete. That I can go to when I'm not really sure what this person is talking about. And it'll work. So if you really condense it, one, they're going to actually hear your question. And two, it forces them, because there's this kind of natural thing as human beings where the shorter your question, I kind of feel this need, especially in those one-on-one situations where we all know they're going to go about a minute 30, you know, 2 minutes, or, you know, an answer, question answer is going to be about 35, 40. I found that, especially with coaches, there's this natural like, all right, well, he or she only used 10 seconds. I got to fill the rest of the 35. So in turn, they actually end up giving them sometimes, hopefully, a more thoughtful response. So that's one of the ways that I try and kind of game the system, if you will, or play with the system, and really, to use the term I used earlier, kind of nerd out on how to ask questions, because I've found that's been much more effective.
I know you were in Detroit last weekend and then Tampa Bay for Wild Card weekend. If you were in Kansas City for the Chiefs Dolphins game with the feels like temperatures of negative 20 degrees, would you have worn a hat?
So here's I should probably admit it. You know, this will be the big headline for this one. There are times where I have had a hat on when I'm not on camera, and then pulled the hat off on camera to project the level. Not even toughness. Look, let's be real. I get a lot of people like to comment on the hair. I think it's hilarious. I take a lot of pride in one appearance. Why wouldn't you? It's fun to feel good, look good, play good, the whole deal. So the game I'm thinking of, Brandon, is the Bills Patriots game. Was that wild card round 2 years ago. And I don't know where that fell. That was right there in the rankings with whatever was going on in KC in terms of coldest games in NFL history. And that was the first time where I actively wore a hat that I can remember and then for a couple on cams, just to hold off. Just to sort of, you know, play the game a little bit. But yeah, I would have been wearing a hat. But a shout out to Dan Weinberg, head of programming, CBS. He gave me earmuffs, or I borrowed. I got to return those, by the way. Oh, maybe I'll do that Sunday. He gave me earmuffs, but not like, you know, kind of the elaborate ones. They like wrap around your neck.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, this is, no, granted, keeping your head warm is good for your brain and state of mind.
Yeah, no, the ears is definitely
ears. Like that was sort of, I thought, I can still keep the lettuce fresh and then also keep your ears warm.
Yeah, I know Ian Eagle is even, he's referenced your hair gel.
Yeah, he like, and I'll put it out here right now. I've tried to get my agent on this, but he does a great job, but he hasn't come through on this one. Men's Crew is the brand.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask, because like, yeah, I could imagine you're probably not just like, no offense to LA Looks, but you're not like gooping on globs of LA.
I've done the whole CBS tour to try and find a comparable replacement, because it runs you like, it's like that little tub of pomade's like $23, and yet it adds, and I don't even think that's a business expense. I got to talk to my accountant. I know suits aren't. Yeah, it adds up, but again, you know, you do what you got to do.
Evan, you were great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
No, happy to do it, Brandon. This was fun. Thanks.
That is Evan Washburn. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.